folks, welcome to the Hunter's Quest podcast. This is your host, Hunter McWaters. It's great to be with you as always. I want to say welcome if you're new. If you've been listening for a long time, I appreciate your support, and it's good to be back with you. This week, I have a really, really fascinating conversation with the legendary Jim Shockey. And I can tell you guys, after just talking to him for a little bit and kind of studying his life, Jim is the real deal. He's a consummate professional. He's an excellent ambassador for hunting, a thoughtful guy, you know, a self-proclaimed naturalist and a conservationist, and just a great voice for hunters. And he's, like I said, he's the real deal, and he's somebody that I could genuinely say I would love to be them when I grow up. So bear with me, though, because this is the first time I can really ever remember being slightly nervous at the beginning of a podcast talking to somebody. So there's a couple times when I like fumble around a little bit. But, you know, I think we kind of get into a groove and we get going, and it's a really great conversation. And we kind of dive into some stuff that I'm not really sure that Jim's talked about much on any other podcast to this point. So also want to mention, he just released a book called Call Me Hunter. It's an awesome book. When we recorded this podcast, I was only, I think, 14 or 15 chapters in. I've since finished the book, and it's an amazing, amazing story. Another great example of how Jim is kind of wading into some of the waters of the non-hunting world and being an excellent ambassador for hunters, trying to change some of that public opinion about us, because like I said, he is kind of the best of what we can be and what we should shoot for and strive to be, and to represent hunters and to the non-hunting world. So lastly, I want to mention one more thing. I'm super excited that on May 31st on my YouTube channel, I'm going to be releasing my first ever elk hunt. It's a New Mexico muzzleloader elk hunt that I drew last year in a premium unit. The elk were bugling, they were screaming their faces off. You know, I had multiple stalks and different opportunities. And like I said, it was my first ever elk hunt in this crazy awesome unit, and my first ever successful elk hunt as well. As you can see behind me, I finally got my skull back. So spoiler alert, but it went down in dramatic fashion. There was some shenanigans there towards the end, and it definitely got Western, to use the cliche. But I'm also going to be teaming up with CVA, since this was a muzzleloader hunt, and we're doing a giveaway. Now, this is the first time I've ever done a giveaway. I've been waiting. I've been holding it in the pocket, waiting for the right time, their opportunity, and this is that time. So when that film drops on May 31st, if you subscribe to my channel, you subscribe to the CVA YouTube channel, and you leave a comment on that video, you're going to be entered to win a CVA Acura of your choice. It's a great muzzleloader. It's the one I used on this hunt, and you can get an LRX or an MRX, and you know, we can dive into the details and the differences there, but it's a great muzzleloader, and I'm super excited to be teaming up with CVA to give one of those away. And all you gotta do is subscribe to my channel, subscribe to CVA's channel, and leave us a comment on that video. So be on the lookout May 31st, my first ever elk hunt film, successful elk hunt, and it's a doozy. So I'm really proud of it, and I hope you guys will check that out. Last thing I'm going to say is I had a verse come to mind this week as I was getting ready for this intro, as I sometimes do. And me and Jim kind of talk about how certain guys that just walk in a certain way, in a certain lifestyle, and with a certain confidence, they seem like they can just be prosperous and successful at whatever they choose to do. And for me, that comes from my foundation of faith in Jesus and my walk with the Lord. So the verse this week is from Psalm chapter 1, verses 1 through 3. Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the wicked, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of scoffers, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night. He is like a tree planted by streams of water that yields its fruit in season, and its leaf does not wither. In all that he does, he prospers. So I hope you guys will heed that advice and walk with God and meditate on him, and you will prosper in all that you do. So hope you guys have a great week. Thanks for listening. Let's jump right into this podcast with the legend himself, Mr. Jim Shockey. See you on the next one. How's the show going? Shock therapy.
Great. Yeah, I'm starting to, it always takes a new show. When we started Hunting Adventures, that took the longest for people to catch on to what we were doing. When we created Professionals, that was a little bit quicker. Uncharted was a little quicker again. Uncharted Yukon. Shock therapy is a totally different format, and it's taken a couple of years for the guys to realize that, hey, this is kind of cool. You're the background story behind all those hunts and adventures. Now you're getting the background that we couldn't tell you in that 14 and a half minutes that we have for editorial space in a half hour show. So yeah, now I'm starting to get a lot of guys coming up. Oh, I love your podcast. Love your podcast. Because that's essentially what it is a televised podcast with visuals, as opposed to just two people talking. There's actual footage they can watch while we're talking.
I experimented with my show in the first season with doing that. So basically, I didn't have enough time to do like 10 episodes, like 10 trips, 10 hunts in 1 year. So I kind of filled it in with some experimented with some like interview style episodes. It's a interesting kind of melding of two worlds there, TV and podcast. I like it.
Well, I think that was the only thing missing on the podcast were visuals. I mean,
Yeah.
if you're in a truck driving around and listening, that's one thing. Then it's all audio. But if you're watching a screen and two guys, I mean, you and I are incredibly handsome guys, but people are going to get sick and tired of looking at our faces
Of
after a few
course.
minutes. And so you lose the audience a little bit. And that's why the visuals are so important. I mean, your eyes, your sight. I mean, that's your senses. You want to fill it with stimulus if you can. So that's why we went with the format that we have. And it's actually, it was in the Professionals. It was the last 5 minutes of our Professionals television show that we kind of used the Best Damn Sports Show as a template for that. That we wanted to talk with the guys that were on that hunt, talking about the things we'd seen during the hunt. So we just expanded that 5 minutes to, so we were doing this back in the Professionals. That would be, gosh, 15 years ago, probably before the first podcast. I'm sure it was.
It's you never really get that stuff. That's kind of what I'm dealing with now is like you go on these crazy adventures, and so you have all this content, and it's just kind of hard to squeeze it all in. I love how you guys did it with Uncharted. Like, that was such a cool show for me, just showing the cultural aspect. And it kind of like to me is kind of who you are is, which is something I kind of want to talk about, is like an ambassador for hunting. I feel like I've heard you talk on other podcasts about how, we've gotten a bad rap in the media, and I love all that you're doing, like with the book and how you did Uncharted and some of your other work to like really, and that's kind of what I'm always trying to figure out how to do is to reach out to that 80% that might not be the diehard hunters, but they aren't the people whose opinions you're never going to change, the extremists, so how do we reach those folks? And you've done a really cool job with the stuff lately. So, love to hear about that a little bit.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I appreciate that. I mean, it's true. Historically, 10% of us hunted of humanity, and 10% of us hated us that hunted, probably because they were entirely jealous of our ability of hunters to provide for our families, ourselves, our families, and the community. I mean, I'm not a scientist, and I'm jumping to a little bit of conclusions there, tongue in cheek, that they were that 10% was jealous, but they were the
Sure.
balance.
I mean, back then it was scary. You're going out, you're leaving camp, it's uncomfortable, you're going after dangerous game, probably.
Sure. I mean, and if you don't succeed, you starve. And you starve personally, your family also starves, and your spouse, who you can procreate and make more children, so your children might starve. I mean, that's,
It's a lot of pressure.
and the community starves, and then you're weak and you can be taken over by another community. So it's, hunting and hunters were a vital part of why we're here today. And to deny it is just hypocrisy. Every single one of us on this planet today is here because our ancestors were great hunters. And so, to tell that story to that 80% that's in the middle, and they'll swing, us over here, we're 10% of the hunt, they're hate hunters. then the 80% kind of swing this way or this way, depending on their what they've read in the newspaper that week, really. Cecil the Lion's the big story, then they
Right.
lean towards the hating hunters. But if you get a positive story about hunters feeding the hungry, then they lean towards the hunters. The problem is, media nowadays is big business. So they have a bottom line that they're trying to, justify to their board of directors. And bad news sells for $2. Good news sells for $1. So Cecil sells for $2. What do you think they're going to go with? The story of hunters feeding the hungry or Cecil the Lion and oh, the world's
Yeah.
ending? So they go with the bad stories and
If it bleeds, it leads, right?
yeah, sure, yeah. It's important for us, every one of us that has a voice, and every single hunter has a voice with to the people around them, their immediate
That's true.
family and friends and acquaintances. We, some of us have a bigger voice. You're reaching out with your podcast to how many people? There's a voice, and we it's important that we use it, like you said earlier, as ambassadors to hunting, for hunting, to change the minds of those 80%, so that they understand that no, we're not evil. We're good people, and hunting isn't just about the kill. Hunting is, back to Uncharted, about the culture, the adventure, the camaraderie, family, humor, adventure again. And the animals are a part of it. And that's Ortega de Gasset, the Spanish philosopher, said, I don't hunt to kill, I kill to have hunted. So the kill isn't the important part of it, but it's got to be part of it, because even if we don't get something, the action of seeking for, lying in wait for, searching for, tracking, that's all hunting. But also, this, us talking together, this is hunting. The camaraderie that we have with the people listening, that's hunting. The meat that we had for breakfast, whether it was steak and eggs, but the steak was a deer, that's hunting.
Yeah.
The memories on your wall I see behind you, those are trophies to some people, and that's negative. But in fact, trophy by definition is a memory of an event or an accomplishment, and that's, to us, it's the memories. That's all part of it. And the skill set we need to be able to be hunters. We all know that as hunters, but the non-hunters don't. So it's important that we get that messaging out every single chance we get to anyone who will listen.
Yeah, and it's that's what I try to tell people all the time is like the kill is a big part of it, but that's also a very small part of it, in the grand scheme of things. I'm fascinated by you, your museum, your book, and all that stuff. I want to talk about all this stuff, but I kind of just want to hear a little bit. I've listened to a lot of podcasts with you, and I haven't heard a ton. Maybe I missed it, but of like you really telling much of your backstory. So I'd love to just hear a little bit about like kind of how you got where you are and doing what you're doing.
How far back do you want to go on my backstory? What do you got?
As far as you'll go, and just I'll preface that with I'm about 14 or 15 chapters into your book, and like I'm the way you set it up in the intro and everything, I'm like trying to figure out like which parts are autobiographical about you. But
Yeah.
anyway, we can talk about that later, but
Yeah. Just to answer that real quick, what I say that they've got it classified as a fictional thriller. They had to put it in a category,
yeah.
a genre, but it really should be an abstract autobiographical fictional thriller. And there is a lot of truth in that novel, Call Me Hunter, my novel that Simon and Schuster published and released this last October. It
There's
went,
a great audiobook version too, which I've been listening to.
yeah, that I got Scott Brick to do the audio, and I do the very few, like a handful, three or four novels that have ever been written have second person perspective in them.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I wrote part
And then
of
your
my novel.
voice comes in there.
That's right. So I
That's
actually do
awesome.
the audio for the second person perspective, because it had, and Scott Brick, I insisted, he did all the Clive Cussler novels and, all the Michael Crichton books. He's to me the best. Now there's really good audio guys out there, but I wanted him.
Yeah, he does a good job.
Quick story, they actually had 21 voices for me to choose from.
Wow.
Simon & Schuster, they wanted seven different characters to play the different characters of the book, like a radio drama, I guess. But and that's the way books are going. But my novel, when I listened to the 21 voices, it was like listening to a bunch of millennials, no offense, You know, they haven't, they haven't, you know, the characters in my book have been to the edge of life. Like they live out there on the edge. They're hardened by a lifetime of seeing things, you know, that no man should see, and going places where no man should be. You know, sailing all seven seas kind of thing. And these, like, oh, I mean, Valley Girl stuff. It's like, oh my God.
Well, I know I'm not very far in, but you do a good job with character development because Hunter's dad, which that's my name. I
Oh
don't
yeah.
know
I'm in. I got stuck with Jim.
if you, but yeah, the dad, Hunter's dad, like I can't stand that
He,
guy.
you know, I actually had to tone
He
him
makes me
down.
so mad.
In the original version, he was harsher than that.
Really? Okay.
People nowadays were sort of, I don't know, we're soft. You know, back in the day, you know, those fathers, you know, I mean, my father never told me he loved me, and for absolute sure, his father never. I mean, he was a hard guy. I mean, they
Yeah.
lost one in every ch 10 childbirths ended in losing your soulmate, your spouse. You know, like that was the gamble when you had children. The reality was that love was a luxury, and they just you just couldn't love because you're probably going to lose them to disease, and so that was a harder time, and that character was a throwback to that harder time. But I had to tone him because it was too harsh for today's
Yeah.
soft readers. You know, so it was. I toned him down a little bit. So as much as you hate him, you would have hated him worse. But have you bumped into Jabago yet?
I just got to the part where they're introducing him. Like the part where I don't know how, like they go to Russia, I guess, or somewhere. I just got
Yeah,
there.
yeah, yeah. You'll get it. You'll hate somebody worse than the father. Trust
I bet.
me.
No, it's a really, really intriguing book. Like it's different. And I love that you're, like I said, like just reaching out into kind of different worlds as a hunter, you know.
Yeah,
That's
well, as I was saying, what I tell people is it's 80% truth and 20% that will put anybody in jail. That's the fiction part of the book. So you'll get into all that as you read into it. And you're just started. By the time you get to about chapter 30 or chapter 15, then you won't be able to put it down. It'll have you, the
Yeah.
deeper you get sucked into that vortex of that novel. Like I say, and it's not a beach read. It's actually a fairly complicated read. It could have been in literature, but
Oh yeah.
it's what I originally wanted it. But the publishers of literature, they said they never read it. They Googled me and said, "Oh, you're way too much of a celebrity. You can't possibly write literature."
Huh.
And you know, I guess because I'm not a down and out depressive suicidal
Gender confused.
I mean, whatever the issues are, you know, I guess you have to be all that to be able to write literature, you know, down and outer, right? Or at least, you know, a brilliant down and outer. So
Right.
they said, no, you can't. So it had to go into commercial fiction, which is fine. There's more money in that, but you know, I always was kind of hoping it would end up in as literature because I
Yeah.
think it's, like I say, it's not an easy read. You can read it at many levels. You know, the deeper you get down into it. And there's parts of that book that are written for one person, you know, written for two
Wow.
people, written for a family out there that when they're reading it, they'll recognize. And I entertain myself through the novel writing that and hoping that someday someone's going to try and dig through all that and figure out what's actually what.
Interesting. Well,
But
it's
back to your original, so I got sidetracked there.
No, it's okay.
The start of me, I was born in Saskatchewan, Canada. You know, lived in a trailer park and followed my dad around construction sites where he was working on road construction. And in the winter, he'd be fixing. He was heavy duty mechanic in the winter, so we lived in a trailer park. And if he didn't get his moose every fall, we didn't eat meat. We didn't have a lot of
Oh,
money.
wow.
It was macaroni. So it was a big deal when dad would show up after the annual Shawkey moose hunt. You know, him and his brothers would go out try and get meat for all the families.
Wow.
If they'd show up with, I'd see moose feet sticking out of the back of the pickup bed. That was a big deal, and even better if I saw antlers. But you know, eventually they bought a house, and the conversation every day was, whether dad would get laid off, whether he would have the money, lose the house, more, So this is what I listened to at 10 years of age. And it really, at that point, I realized I was different than my dad, and I would never live that life. I just not going to do it. I determined at 10 that I was going to write a novel because I was reading by then. I couldn't read. Went to a psychiatrist. They took me in to figure
Okay.
out what this kid's problem was because he wouldn't read C. Dick
Dropping some
runs.
hints, dropping some hints.
Yeah, there you go. You read the parts. But by then, by the time I was 10, I was reading voraciously, and
Okay, I gotta ask, the animal thing, is that true?
yeah.
Animals, are they attracted to you?
I don't want to. I don't want
You don't want to go too deep on it?
to. Yeah. Well, the reason is because it sounds like you're A, weird, and B, that there's I believe in sort of the heebie-jeebie outside, but I think there's no question that there's people that have a closer spiritual relationship with animals, and most of those that I know are hunters. The people that truly care, they've got a Disney land view of what animals are.
Right.
They
Well, you have
care.
the
They're
depth of perspective of being a part of nature and seeing it up
right.
close and knowing
As
it.
a, exactly. That's a hunter, as opposed to they're not natural. They're Disneyfied, and they're these cute little animals. You see it all the time, and it's cute. I mean, it's cute when they put a lion and a lamb together and they play together when they're babies. It's
Right.
cute, and it gives that it gives a false impression of what nature's really about. And there's people, their hearts are there. They truly love these animals,
Right.
but they want to love them in a way that fits into their narrative.
Sure.
That animals are not like brutes when they want to be and have to be in nature. So they separate us from nature, separate themselves, separate the animals, and they don't embrace what nature is truly about. And hunters and the people that I think have an actual deep spiritual relationship with the animals, they know that we are part of nature. Yes, we're changing things on this planet. There's 8 billion of us. Of course, we're changing things, but we're instruments of nature's change. We're not above nature doing this. We are nature. We are natural, and that means, if we keep that philosophy and that perspective, then you realize, well, okay, well, we actually do kill animals to eat. I mean, right now today, I'd love somebody to do a study to figure out how many animals are killed every single day on this planet. Animals, or animals, living creatures, and living creatures meaning not plants, but actual, like clams I mean, mice, whatever. How many do we kill as human beings? Of course we're killing. And anyone that says that they don't kill is just hypocrisy. I mean, you drive your car down a highway, you're killing grasshopper after grasshopper after grasshopper, probably the odd bird, and occasionally hit a deer, and maybe a cat. I mean, they can't say they don't kill. That road that's paved used to be habitat for what? All kinds of little critters, and we killed them off to build that road, and they're driving on that road saying we don't kill animals. Well, come
Yeah,
on.
for sure.
I mean, we're part of nature, and for whatever reason, nature decided to endow us with this that allows us to do what we're doing right now inside buildings that are, not anthills. They're actually pretty fancy buildings, and quickly.
Yeah. Well, I gotta ask at this point though, then do you think is it nature that, or what are your thoughts on God?
Well, well, the scientists have never explained it adequately yet, and they admit it. The Big Bang. Okay, it started. Okay, well, so you're saying it was created by something, or
Yeah.
something created something. It was nothing here, and then suddenly it's there.
Something that happened has to have something that caused something to happen.
Well, cause and effect. I mean,
Right.
this is science. Equal and opposite reaction. Something happened. So, yeah. I mean, to deny that there's some greater force out there is just absurd, and it means you're closing your eyes and your ears and just using your letting your mouth yap, because look around, look at these creations. Now, I've traveled enough around the world over 306 days on average for 20, 25 years. I've seen really smart people that I respect with hugely varying opinions
Right.
on God, but they have some, you know, Shiva, or they have Muhammad, or they have, you know, their animism, Zeus. They have always a higher power in their thought process. Even us nowadays, we've lost our faith in religion, but we still need to believe in something, so we believe in science. So science is our new religion, and we're, you know, that's why we're paying homage to science and penance. You know, we're gonna pay so many extra taxes because we're gonna, science tells us we're killing this world. So, you know, I'm not gonna be part of the killing of the world.
I'm at the point now where, like, if I hear something is quote unquote science, I pretty much automatically say, like, believe it's not true.
Well, I mean, that's pretty cynical, because there's probably
No,
some.
I'm exaggerating a little bit, but I did have an interesting conversation with one of my guests the other day, though, who's a cos astronomer, and he was saying in like social sciences and like biology and stuff, you have very low rates of people that are surveyed that believe in God, but once you get to like mathematicians and astronomers and like cosmologists and stuff, almost all of them believe in some form of creator.
Well,
It's interesting.
that's it, exactly right. A creator, that's what I consider it to be, as a creator. And our
Yeah.
First Nation here in Canada, it's the creator. What, you know, what that, like I say, there's many different names for that around this world, and they fight against each other trying to, you know, because you got it wrong and we got it, but you still believe the same thing. It's just, it's the Bible or the Quran, whatever they're following, dictates that they, you know, they have to convert as many people as they can to what they believe. And that's, I think that's great. It's wonderful. It's part of being human, and it's part of religions and faiths. If you really truly believe in something, then sure, you want the rest of the world to understand that your way is the right way. You know, my way is my cathedral is the outdoors, the mountains, the forests. That's where I worship. And yeah, of course, there's some greater force that's not explained yet by science, not adequately anyway. When they come up with a, you know, a concise, provable, repeatable experiment to show that, yeah, there is no God, then I mean, until they come up with that, and I don't foresee it in the near future, and certainly not, you know, in the even in the little further future. But yeah, there's greater forces than us out there,
Yeah, for
absolutely.
sure. Okay, we went down a crazy rabbit trail there, but anyway, you were a kid growing up in the trailer park. Let's get back to that.
Yeah, at the age of 10, I determined what I was going to do with my life, which was not work like my dad and have somebody telling me that I might get laid off next week. So, you know, to me, it seemed, even at that age, you get one life. So why wouldn't you do what you want? He loved to hunt. He loved to fly airplanes. Well, why didn't you get a job hunting or flying airplanes? You know, that if that's your job, then you get to do exactly what you love every single day. And I decided then, at the age of 10, that I'd be a novelist. I'd write novels,
That's awesome.
novel, and I would create a museum. And I said, I'm going to use my life to those ends, and I'm not going to vary off that course.
Wow. You had that clear of a vision for what you wanted to do at 10.
Yeah, 100%. I started collecting for this museum at 10. Seashells. The local church you bring five friends to Sunday school, and they'll give you a conch shell. You know, a conch shell in Saskatchewan was like the, you know, Jason's golden fleece. I mean, it just a conch shell. I don't even know where they came from. Yeah, and if I brought five friends to Sunday school, I'd get one of those. So I still that is still in my museum. I took five friends and got the conch shell and started my museum collection. I
That's amazing.
pretty rocks didn't cost me anything. Other seashells, you know, clam shells, freshwater clam shells, whatever, snail shells, insects, they were all free, and I could borrow fishing lures from my dad's tackle box, or even better, my grandfather's tackle box, and those are all in the museum still.
Wow.
And that's where I, you know, I started collecting, and aiming my life towards that, and determined never to take a sidetrack. I mean,
Did it ever waver, or you might think at least one time where you were like, "Oh, that was just a child, a childish dream." Did you have those phases, or did you always know?
you know, always knew. I was never a. You know,
That's
someone asked
awesome.
me on a podcast recently, you know, if you had, you know, he said, what's your biggest regret? And I said, well, I don't have any. And he said, well, everybody's got some regrets. You know, okay, give me, you know, a couple of your smaller regrets. And I said, well, I honestly don't have any. I made every choice along the way based on the best of my knowledge at that time, and they didn't always prove out to be right, the right choices, depending on what I was trying to accomplish. Wrong doesn't make it a regret. It just means I didn't have knowledge when I made the choice. And so, I never varied from that course and
That's
never
awesome.
regret it.
What do you think your motivation was? Was it just life is short? I don't want to live like kind of, paycheck to paycheck and not happy. It's like,
Here's the thing about motivation. People say, "Oh, that guy's really motivated." No, that person has desire. Desire is that magical element that from that comes to motivation, comes discipline, comes effort, sacrifice. But it's all because of your desire. So my desire was always to live this one life. Every single day I realized was precious. And I'd see my dad, his days being stolen from him, 15-hour days, 16-hour days on the road construction crew. I went and worked for the summers for him on the road construction. Well, he was foreman, and I was a rock picking laborer. But I saw how he worked. I was working 14-hour days at 14 years of age, getting $1.75 an hour. That's how I saved enough money for my first rifle. And they would work half a day on Saturdays. Living in a bunkhouse, 3 hours away from home, he couldn't commute. And then he would work longer because he had to do all the paperwork, whatever else was going on at night. And I, to me, he was a slave. And I don't mean that disrespectfully. And I mean, I love my father, but we were different. I just felt, boy, his thing was you get a job and you get paid. Now, he grew up in the 30s, the Depression era, the dirty 30s. And so a job was a huge, big deal. You got a job, you hung on to it. He worked for that company for 45 years.
Sure.
And his advice to me was always, you get a job and you do your best for the boss. It's like, well, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to be my
Life's
own boss.
short. Yeah.
Yeah, and I love hunting, and you love hunting, Dad. I mean, you'd get 1 week a year to go get our moose, and that's it. And so I just decided I wasn't going to get caught in that. I was never going to make a decision that would take me in that direction.
Well, there. It's interesting because the two things you mentioned at 10 years old are the two things that like you've kind of just recently kind of completed or accomplished, your novel and the museum. There was a whole lot of hunting and TV making in the middle. When did that come in?
Well, that's the financing, the goal, right?
Okay.
Yeah, and I wanted to live a life that I wanted to live, not live a life where someone else is telling me I got to be in work at 9 o'clock and punch a clock. And no disrespect to anybody, just not everybody knows what to dream. That's the problem with a lot of the world today. We say, well, we just do what we do. This we're supposed to do this. No, we're not. We can do whatever we want. It's our life. I mean, I don't know if you're following me on social media. I lost my wife here last
I know.
year
I'm
after.
sorry for your loss, man. I talked to Brandlin a little bit about it too.
Yeah, there is no greater sorrow, I don't believe. At least I've never experienced it. Obviously, I can't speak for losing a child, but a spouse, 39 years, 113 days, 14 and a half hours, Louise and I were
Wow.
soulmates. I never cheated on her, but I was. I just worshiped the ground she walked on. It was a fairy tale.
Beautiful thing.
And when she was diagnosed, we knew she was sick for quite a while before that. We just couldn't figure it out. I sent her to the Mayo Clinic. They misdiagnosed it. And that was 3 years before they finally got the diagnosis right. But we had 2 years to say goodbye to each other and mourn and grieve and hold hands and talk about the future. And when you're truly in love with somebody, you don't want them to hurt and suffer beyond your passing. You want them to move on. It's not possessiveness, and you want them to actually go find happiness. The last thing you want when you love somebody is for them to be unhappy, sad, grieving, sorrowful, lonely, depressed, and possibly suicidal. Is that what anybody wants when they love somebody? No, it's what somebody wants when they care about themselves and more than the person that they're leaving in this earth. So Louise and I had all this time to talk, and she told me, go, upon my passing, you start looking for someone else because she knows I like companionship and I like female, companionship. And she said, you look, but she told me She told me, but you wait 6 months before you make a decision. And that, you know, so okay. So, you know, I did what she wanted, but you know, now on social people are saying I've got a new lady friend in my life, a
Okay,
companion.
I wasn't gonna bring it up, but hey, you brought it up, so you have a new lady
Oh, yeah.
friend.
Hey, I live out in public, so it's a,
Yeah.
but I do that because I think it helps a lot of people that and it allows, I'm hoping that from my life, people understand, even our museum, we need more tolerance in this world. Stop judging people. And
For
we talked
sure.
about the religions. You know, I've seen so many smart people that have absolutely opposite opinions of God, you know, Muhammad, Jehovah, whatever you want to name that person, Zeus, or I mean, I don't know, whatever those top guys are. And it, you know, if they tolerate each other, it would be a lot better world. So I don't judge. But I, you know, I have recently, you know, found a young lady that sing, you know, never single, never married, no children, you know, cancer survivor, two undergraduate degrees, a BA and a BS, and also a doctorate of law.
Oh,
You know,
wow.
was a lawyer, prosecutor in California, you know, and like I say, a serious cancer survivor, and way wiser beyond her years, waiting for the right guy in her life. You know, not cynical, jaded,
Right.
and caught up in a career. That's why she's single, just waiting. You know, and I mean, when we met, it was like, honestly, it was like Louise sent her to me. And, but she's younger than me, and people are judging. They say, well, you know, that's terrible. You
But
shouldn't.
she doesn't look like, you know, she doesn't look like insane, like way too young. You know what I mean? She looks to me, I mean, I remember being like, oh, she's age appropriate.
You know, I mean, depending on your definition of age appropriate. I mean, she's not 20, you know, you know,
Exactly.
she's almost 40, and which would make her a cougar technically. And you know, I'm 66. There's a big difference in our age, but we're happy together, happy. And you know what? People are judging. Well, you shouldn't do that. You know, you shouldn't. That's wrong. Okay, what? So I'm supposed to tell this beautiful young lady that I'm not going to see you because this is wrong that we're both happy, and please go look for another guy, and I'm going to look for somebody older than you who's single, unmarried, never had children, you know, that still has my energy level and doesn't want to sit in a rocking chair with a blanket over and watch the
Right.
sunset. You know, I'm still active
Yeah, you do not seem like a 66-year-old.
well, I can't tell you that I don't look like a 66-year-old, but I, you know, I take care of myself. You know, I'm. You know, yeah, there's health issues as you get older. You can't, there's a lot of wear and tear on this carcass.
Yeah. Because you lived life the right way, not sitting on a couch or behind a
Yeah,
computer screen.
that's the joie de vivre, the joy of life. And I have it. Every single day is precious. And I kind of laugh when these people say, oh, you know, that's not right. You looks like, you know, the same age as your children, which she's not, she's older.
Yeah.
But you know, that's their interpret, because they don't know how old she is. And they, it's wrong. And they say, well, wait a minute, I'm happy. You know, I'm happy. And I'm not mourning and in sorrow and depressed and sitting at home and lonely. And I have the option of going out with a younger woman. Why would, tell me again, why wouldn't I give, like
Yeah.
really, like everybody, give your head a shake.
There's always haters, no matter what you do, man. There's always going to be people that are throwing shade, especially at guys like you. And I just feel like, because I'm starting to see a little bit of that, even from like the antis, but then there's also people in our own community that want to, hate on us or whatever. But I imagine, like, as you get to your level, that just increases, in correspondence with the level of influence you have.
Well, I think we talked about that off air there just before we started, that
Yeah.
you know, if you know 100 people, 90 people you either like, or your friends, or they're, you know, just ambivalent, and then there will be 9 people out of those 100 that for whatever reason you don't get along with, you're just personality conflicts, and then there's one for whatever reason that hates your guts. So that's if you know 100 people.
Yeah.
If you know 1,000 people, there's 10 now.
Yeah.
If you know a million people, you've got 10,000 people that hate your guts.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't know if I did my math right there. I was calculating quickly in my head, but it's, you know, the reality is that there's, it's not that you're any worse, but as we all know, the people with a problem or and an issue are the ones that are the most vocal about, you know, making everybody understand that they have an issue with something. People that people that agree and get along with others and live and let live, you know, they're not the ones on social that are saying how wonderful, you know. And that said, there's some that do, thank goodness, and they outnumber those naysayers and haters by 10 to 1. So you know that it's probably more like 100 to 1 when it comes right down to it, because other people aren't saying anything.
For sure. Yeah. It's always the squeaky wheel that gets the grease, I guess.
Well, the squeaky wheel is one you hear.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean, you know, what it needs to be is probably replaced. You got a bearing, so go fix it,
Yeah.
not just grease it. But it is, yeah, they're the ones we hear. And I like I say, I also get the DMs, the direct messages from people that are widowers or widows, and we understand each other. We are the
Sure.
only ones that can talk, because anyone that thinks they understand and imagine what it's like to lose a spouse after almost 40 years of true love, fairy tale life together, they don't have a clue. And they say, well, I would never do that. Oh, give me a break. You've never been there. Imagination, they can't imagine it, because imagination doesn't live where that depth of sorrow exists. If it did, I swear nobody would ever fall in love. They would just say, no,
Wow.
I like you way too much, go away. Because the sorrow, the depth of sorrow is, it's unimaginable. We just can't imagine it. So like I say, the other widowers and widows, they talk, we talk,
Right.
they understand. And they said, yeah, I was judged, you know. And when you've truly experienced true love, not just companionship and friendship with somebody, or even, you know, you tolerate each other and one dies. When you have true love, it's easy to A, find it again, accept it again, and recognize it again. That's the same thing they've all told me. I found somebody within 3, 6 months, and the kids all hated it, and you know, my family and my friends all ostracized me, and you know, there's 22 years difference, and this is women and men. I mean, I met a woman 28 years difference between her husband that she's with now, and I get it. You know,
Yeah.
she's old, she's older, and I get it. I mean, we understand each other. She's happy, and that's what people don't understand, is that it's your happiness. You've suffered a loss greater than anyone can imagine.
It's like a piece of you dies, I mean, honestly. 'Cause you've been so intertwined for so long. I mean, I don't know for sure, but I'm assuming.
Well, there you go. It's like, you will hopefully never know for sure, but every
Yeah.
single one of us out there will eventually know this. If you're in true love, it just happens.
Yeah,
It's life.
I can't imagine, man.
It's, you know, and the kids, you know, people's concerned, well, what do your kids think? Well, you know, the kids lost a mother. You know, I can replace a best friend. I can replace a lover. You know, I can replace a spouse. All those things are replaceable. You can never replace Louise and my relationship. That's
Right.
sacrosanct. That's there. It's never going to be touched. Those memories are sacred. They're mine, and you know, hers. We shared them, and they're not going away. I think about her every hour. Every hour or something. You know, there's a reminder of that was my life for that long. But I can replace a best friend, and I can replace a lover. You know, the kids cannot ever replace a mother. It's impossible to replace a mother. So their grieving is a different deal. And they also weren't there every single day for 2 years, holding hands, talking for 10 hours a day. They were there as much as they could be, but you know, they had their own families to go back to and stay with, you know, their husband and their wife and their children. You know, they had that to go home to. You know, when you're a widow or a widower, you're coming back to an empty house. You know, and the loneliness, no one can understand that unless they've been through it. So like I say, it's a small club, and a very sad club to be a part of, but we're kindred spirits, and we understand. And those are the ones that we understand each other, and everybody else's opinion doesn't matter. And there's people out there that are hurting, and there's nowhere to turn, because your friends don't understand. They can't understand. So me living this life out in public and talking about it and bringing it out in the open is, it helps a lot of people. And so I'll continue to do it. And I honestly, everybody that hates me, what are you going to do? Send me home? I mean, you know, I've walked the walk. I've, yeah, I don't need to prove myself or justify it to anybody out there, but I do need to educate and hopefully help people become a little more tolerant of people that are going through that kind of a thing in their life.
Yeah. Well, I can't fully understand because I haven't experienced it, like you said, but as far as much as you can understand something, I think you articulated it very well, and I don't, I think I'm glad you're happy, man. That's all I'll say. So,
Good. Well,
glad you guys found each other
I
and stuff
consider
like
you a friend then. And
that.
the people, and you know quickly who your friends are because they, the
Yeah.
ones that care about you and care about how you feel and genuinely are happy for you when you're happy, they don't judge. They don't judge. Near as I can tell, there's no laws about being involved with someone who's in their,
No.
fourth decade of their life. It's there are just no laws on it. People are people. There's envy, jealousy, and there's also judgment. I mean, look at the seven deadly sins. I mean, we're not. I prefer to try and follow the seven heavenly virtues as opposed to the seven deadly sins. But I mean, every one of us is human being, and we can't. I mean, gluttony. I have a real difficulty with that because I love eating Cheetos now and Twizzlers,
Yeah.
who am I to say that I don't succumb to it as well?
We've all got flaws, man. That's for sure.
Sure, and there, but it's not flaws. It's human
Yeah.
nature. I mean, you try and control it. Envy, that deadly sin. I truly think it's steals so many people's days. They just and for whatever reason, But yeah, I try to live with the seven heavenly virtues.
Yeah. So going back to that, so tell me a little bit more about your career, and 'cause I know it's got to be more than just there's a better way to make bucks if your only motivation was to fund your novel and your museum. Like, there's better ways than like making a hunting TV show to make a buck. So, what was
Yeah,
your like talk me through that a little bit.
there. I'll tell you. I honestly believe with every molecule of my body, if I wanted to make $200 or $300 million in my life, I could have done that easily. I think that's just like it was, that was, it's almost looking at the pathway and going, ugh, that's where I know I'd end up, but I'm not
Right.
interested in that because I wouldn't be living the life I wanted. I'd make the money to live the life I wanted, but I would have wasted my life making the money to live the life I wanted, and there's no
Yeah.
life left. So, let me see. How can I'll take you back to my first deer. First deer hunting. My dad and my uncles, if they could get their deer opening morning, they were happy and be back at work by that afternoon, whatever, fixing trucks or whatever they did. So if a deer ran out, if four deer ran out and there's four of us hunting, they would go bang, 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 bang. And whatever guy that they ran by, they would shoot him and the rest of us would have to tag him, or the rest of dad's brothers would have to tag him. And they were happy. They didn't, they, it wasn't, it was purely a hamburger running across the field.
Yeah. It's like, I got to get this done, get some meat, and get back to work as soon as possible.
Because it's meat. And how much does it cost to me? It costs me work. Well, that's money. And we don't have a lot of money, so we need to get that animal dead and get the meat into the freezer as quickly as we can and get back to work. And so if someone else shoots it, it was illegal as heck. I never fortunately had to ever tag one of my uncle's deer. Phew, I'd have been so upset. But it was not me. To me, at that age, even at 14, I knew I wanted my hunt to last until the last minute of the last day of the entire season and hunt every single day. That's a perfect hunt. Theirs was the first minute of the first day, get it done and get the meat in the freezer. So it was, like I say, a hamburger. There was no higher sensibilities involved, no spiritual relationship with the animal. It was a harder time. It was a harder time. They were starving when they were young, eating dandelions for salads. And, they had to, to, so to them, it was just about meat. I had the luxury, and thank goodness, in my life too. But I also knew that it would take money to live a life that I wanted to live. And I loved the things from my museum, natural history and cultural arts. So I went to university. on a swimming scholarship to begin with. I was all American swimmer, but in
Oh,
my
wow.
second year, I switched over to water polo, and I still swam nationals for the swimming, but I was already starting to play water polo, and I was fast, really fast in the water, and had good hands, good ball sense, and I was mean as hell. So my, you know, I had
It's
a
a rough
chip on my,
sport.
yeah, it's a wonderful sport. I
Yeah.
love it. It's you know, I call it a man sport, and I don't mean that in a misogynistic way. It's
I heard, is it true that water polos are like the highest per capita athletes to go into the Navy SEALs? I heard that somewhere.
I wouldn't doubt that at all. They're voted, they've been voted every Olympics as the best male bodies of any of the athletes, because it's so, you know, they're just, you know, it's not just swimming, the long, lanky, you know,
Right.
Michael kind of look. It's, you know, you got to be strong too, and you got to be, you know, you got to have some mass to you. I was a small guy. I was 6'3", 192 in those days, and I was tiny, like not tiny. I was third smallest on our team,
Oh,
and
wow.
we didn't have a big team compared to some of the teams around the world that we played against. But I was chosen for the Canadian national water polo team right away.
Oh,
So I
wow.
swam, I played for Canada at the World Aquatic Championships in Berlin in 78. We boycotted in the Olympics in 80, so I couldn't go because of the Russian invasion of Afghanistan, Jimmy Carter. And then in 82, I went to the World Aquatic Championships in Guayaquil, Ecuador again. In 84, when the Los Angeles Olympics were on, I, you know, we had to centralize with the team for the 6 months before. You had to be together, you know, in your little enclave and training with each other. And I just said, no, I'm getting married. I'm, you know, I have a career already, because by that point, I was, well, I was gonna, you know, I was in antiques, ethnocentric folk art forms of Western Canada, Doukhobor, Mennonite, Hutterite, Ukrainian. Ethnocentric folk forms of furniture and idiosyncratic folk forms. So I had a good business already. My clientele were people like Goldie Hawn,
Well,
and
okay.
you know, I mean, you the who's who. I used to take loads of furniture down to Hollywood and empty out one of my clients' homes of their furniture, load all mine in, and then catered valet parking and flowers everywhere, and have invite all the Hollywood who's who to come and buy things. You know, from, and then we'd empty the house, deliver it all to
This
their home.
after the water polo stuff you started doing this? Okay. Sorry, I'm trying to keep
Well,
it.
I was still doing the water. I was still doing the water polo,
Okay.
but not. I wasn't centralized with the team. So 84 is when I stopped playing water polo.
Okay.
So this would have been right at that about that same time.
Gotcha.
But my purpose in those days was to make enough money to get into the outdoor industry, because I
Okay.
knew I wanted to live that lifestyle, and I loved antiques. I love art,
Right.
which reading in the novel.
Yes. And I guess you noticed, like you said, at age 14, that you had a deeper connection to nature and to hunting than how it was kind of introduced to you, and you wanted more, I guess.
Absolutely. I love sitting still on a stand. Not even, we didn't even have stands in those days, but we pushed bush, you know. So dad and his uncles, they'd set you on one side and they'd push
Right.
deer out through the bush, and they'd run by, bang, 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 running deer. I didn't like that. I way preferred to get into the forest and sit still, wait, lean against a tree and sit for an hour, take 10 steps, wait, and, you know, and maybe take 100 steps all day. And I loved it. You know, that was, to me, I'd see the squirrels and the rabbits and the bush partridges. Well, you know, we rough grouse, we call them bush partridges. Yeah, I was part of nature, you know, and once you slowed that, once you, it's like jumping into a pond, you know, ripples everywhere, waves, and then eventually it slows down, slows down, slows down, and it calms off, and you become part of nature at that point. You know, you're part of that pond now, and the life in that pond, and everything starts to move, the frogs, the snakes, the dragonflies come back, the water skeeters, you know, and it's the same thing in a forest.
I
You
love
enter
that.
the forest, it's like waves, and everything knows you're there. I mean, and now the slower you enter the forest, the better it is, and the shorter time it takes for the forest to come back to stasis. But that's what I loved, was to get into the forest and just become one with the waves, as opposed
Wow.
to a syncopated. You're moving with the forest. You're there, but you're not creating any disruption in the forest, in that forest. You're part of nature. That's what I wanted.
That's
And so,
awesome.
yeah, I had a spiritual relationship with the animals and with nature at a really early age. You asked me earlier if I think that people have that ability. I absolutely, 100%. And I think the best of the best in the hunting world, I'm not talking the ones that have the biggest animals. That doesn't impress me much. I mean, sorry, Shania Twain, for stealing your lines, but that don't impress me much. It's the ones that truly understand hunting that I think are the best hunters. But by the age of 1984 is when I'd already had my antique business going, had a, you know, was going really well, and that's when I took my first step into the outdoor world, my real true calling, to make a living at it. I love the antiques, don't get me wrong. Art and antiques. Louise always told me that I bait and switched her, because I was an art dealer when we met, and suddenly I changed careers the same year, or started to make the change that same year we were married in 1984. Published my first article in a hunting magazine. And when I was looking at the hunting outdoor world and trying to figure out, where can a guy make a living at that's going to give me the lifestyle that I want and help me make my museum? I don't need hundreds of millions of dollars, but I certainly need millions, to this museum. Louise and I started a foundation. We've been working on it for 2 years, and their intention was to donate all the land, the building, and the contents of this museum to the foundation, along with an endowment to cover expenses for the next 40 years. It's a lot of money. It was going to take a lot of money to get to this point. So I was looking at it thinking, well, Bill Jordan's already doing the camo and Toxie. They have that market all trapped. What is there? There's guns. Well, I'm not that mechanical. I'm not an engineer. So, what can I do? I love hunting, kind of good at it, I think. So, okay, how can I actually make a living hunting? And I looked at the world and said, well, guides, they hunt, they get to do it professionally, but they don't make enough money to make a museum down the road. But outfitters, if you do it really well, there were some outfitters that were at the top of the heap in those days that, they were doing well. Guys like Dave Weens and up in Stone Mountain Safari, they flying their own airplanes around. They had lots of wealthy clients. They were so I figured, okay, outfitting is the way to go, but I'm going to have to have a territory, which means I got to be able to sell hunts too. So I started writing for the magazines, and I looked at the magazines and said, well, it's all this how to hunt a deer in its bedroom, how to hunt a deer with the wrong wind, how to, when a storm's coming, hunt a deer. When is the best time to hunt a deer? And I said, well, what happened to the stories that I read when I was young in our Ghostie magazine and Outdoor Life magazine? I mean, this happened to me was my favorite part of Outdoor Life, that little segment.
You
And
want to get back to story.
storytelling, sure, and adventure. That's what I wanted to read. Anybody can write how to. I mean, I can make a how to story up right now. How to hunt deer. Well, follow the three rules. Deer do what they do. They are where they are, and they move when they move. There you go.
You got it,
It's
folks. Jim Shockey
yeah,
said it.
it's, yeah. And just to finish that off, though, the only way to overcome those three rules is time. The more time you spend at it, then it doesn't matter what they do or where they are. It's just time in the forest. That's how you get those big deer. But anyway, back to what I was saying. So I looked at these and said, I want to get back to adventure stories and just tell a story. So that's what I did. And I sold my first magazine article in 1984, same year I was married, to Bow Bender Magazine. Kathleen Windsor was the editor in those days, and I got $42 for that article. And I figured I'm on my new career path. So I've written, I wrote 1,000 articles after that, at least, over the years, and continued to rise my antique business at the same time, hunt as much as I could. Then in somewhere around 1990, I'm not sure, 1991, I had three antique stores in Vancouver, and Ralph Lauren walked in and bought everything basically that I had. So
Wow.
I furnished all of Ralph Lauren's country stores. I believe he was trying to, compete with his own polo brand with country brand. And so we for all my furniture was in those stores across the states and up in Canada. And that gave me enough money to finance buying my first outfitting territory. And I'd already seen the writing on the wall. I'd gone to the local outfitter on Vancouver Island, a guy named Wayne Weeb. And I had long hair and I had an earring and I had a, like I was kind of hippie looking cowboy hat. And Wayne was a big, rough, gruff, old school outfitter guy, big man like a
Right.
bear. Smoke 4 packs a day, and I went to his house and I said, "Hey, you're the outfitter up there, and I've been up in your territory. I kind of got it figured out a little bit. I knew I was going to buy his territory. He just didn't know that." And I said, "I'd like to guide for you." He said, "I'm not going to hire no damn hippie." He literally told me that, and I'd already written for some magazines by then, so he knew who I was.
Okay.
And I said, "Well, I'll tell you what, Wayne, I'll just guide for you for free," and he said, "You're hired." So that was how I got my first guiding job, and
Okay.
by that time I knew all the editors and the magazines and the and television was just starting for outdoor television. Up until 72, there was Kurt Gowdy's American Sportsman, I think he called it. I'm not sure, but they, when Kennedy was assassinated, that pretty well got rid of any of the hunting stuff and gun stuff on TV in 62 or 63, whenever it was. So there was no, it was, there was a dearth of hunting content on television. There was only three networks, ABC, NBC, and CBS, and they would not show hunting content. By 1990, there was cable vision, which 1,000 channels. So I went to North American Hunter magazine, which I was writing for at the time, the biggest hunting club, 700,000 members out of Minneapolis, Minnesota. And they, I went to the editor, Mark LaBarbera, and said, "Hey, I'll take you on a hunt in Vancouver Island for a big black bear. The guide or the outfitters offered me or letting me guide." And I went to Wayne and said, "I can bring in this magazine guy, and they have a television show. They're bringing a camera guy, and we can do a TV show for ESPN.
Oh,
And
nice.
if you're interested in that promotion." And he said, "Of course, Wayne was no dummy." He said, "Yeah, of course, bring him here." So I guided my first hunt on television for ESPN in about 1991, I believe it
Okay.
was.
I remember ESPN Outdoors on Saturday mornings.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that's where I saw you first, probably.
Yeah, that's exactly where it would have been. And then ESPN2, they bumped everything off ESPN, and then everything got bumped off ESPN2 to the TNN, which was a national network at the time, the national network, TNN, which eventually got bought out by Spike TV, and so all the hunting got booted off that, and that's when the outdoor channel started up. So
Interesting.
that's sort of the progression of all the television shows. So I was guiding, writing articles for magazines, hunting magazines, and appearing on the TV shows at that time, in night starting in 1991 for the television, writing for 7 years before that.
Were you kind of the guide, or were you in front of the camera talking and hunting and stuff as well at that point?
Well, here's the thing. When all the writing and the writers, the magazines, those companies started looking at television shows, not every writer could cross over into television, because now it's like not every radio announcer, when you actually
Right.
see them,
Yeah.
you can go,
They don't have on-screen charisma.
they don't have that X factor.
Right.
And so Mark LaBarbera was the
And you
guy
got a
that
double portion.
I was blessed with. I don't care if there's a camera. I'm not going to stutter or numb. And I know. I just don't care that the camera's there. It doesn't even affect my life. Why would I be any different? I know who I am. I'm not going to act different.
Sure.
And those guys that were writers, this was a whole new thing for them. They, and to be fair, a lot of the writers were not. And I don't want to offend anybody here. I certainly won't name names. But they were not actual outdoorsmen. They were writers. I lived it. I spent
Yes.
100 days a year in the forest, and doing real stuff, backpacking and mountain goat hunting and sheep hunting, and I have a certain look, and it translated well to television. And that ability to speak when a camera's there and not really care and crack jokes and be just be me, I had that, I don't know. That's was, I don't know, my superpower, I guess. And not every writer in those days that wanted to be the host of the TV shows, because they were the big time writer, they just didn't, it just didn't work.
Right, just
So
didn't have it.
I very quickly was in front of the camera, and started getting a following. Already my articles, if I have any, it's actually writing. So I had a following with that. But then the television just upped that a whole bunch. And then I did 5 years with Bill Jordan on his Realtree Outdoors. I had a segment on the show. We used to do home videos. It was at the time I figured, your home videos are, everybody's got video cameras, so let's do a segment. We'll get people to send in footage. It was fun and it was cool footage. And we did that for 5 years. And then I finally, it run its course, because you can't keep things going forever on those shows. You need to freshen them up. So, I left Realtree Outdoors and I started my own Hunting Adventures television show. And that was on the Outdoor Channel. I think the first time we aired was 2002.
Okay, cool.
So it was, I remember at the time you could buy the airtime for $10,000. I don't know what it is now, but it's hundreds of thousands. So the sponsorships were not a big deal. I remember making a big, profile and format and gonna sell it, but what a waste of money. It just, I knew everybody, so you just went to them, yeah, you want to do a TV show? Yeah, let's do it.
Were you pretty much doing everything by yourself at this point? Like, did you do editing and stuff too, or did you work with the team or?
No, it's kind of like my dad was always upset at me that I wasn't interested in fixing, the old Valiant, 1965 Valiant. Why aren't you interested in changing the oil and doing all this stuff? And I said, Dad, it's not going to pay me enough to do that with my time. My time is valuable. It's every minute's precious in this world. And if I learn to do that, then that's what I would be doing, and that's going to sidetrack me from my goal. I can't spend that much time editing. That's where I found Cody Robbins. And Cody was a 19-year-old kid that I don't even think he knew how to turn on a computer. I'm sure he didn't know how to turn on a computer, but he promised me he could and would. And so we started Hunting Adventures. Now I had edited the first three of my VHS videos. So the Hunting Giant Canadian Whitetails back about 1996, seven, somewhere in there. And that was those VHS format tapes. And I had actually, with my television and playing the tapes that we recorded back and forth, recording, telling where this, I want this gnat sound to come in. Now I want voiceover from this section
Wow.
put here. I wrote it all down. So I knew the editing process, because it's just storytelling is all it is.
But you were involved in the process, not, like you were producing the show, kind of you and this other editor, I guess.
Yeah, and that's, who was it at that time? I can't even remember his name, but we produced those first three videos. Forrest Fox did my Hunting Adventures videos. The Hunting Giant Canadian Whitetails was a different fellow, and Forrest Fox then produced the first three or four of my Hunting Adventures videos, which were on VHS format. And then Cody came on board for the first television show,
Okay.
and I was filming myself. I mean, I'd carry tripod cameras and. I said, imagine trying to rattle in a mule deer and video yourself over the shoulder, not in a stand over bait, but actually sneaking up,
Yeah.
setting it, rattling, and trying to get it on camera with me in front of the frame.
Self-filming is next level. There's a couple guys today that still do it. That'd be tough. Because I'm usually with a guy with me filming as well, and it's already hard enough as it is.
And that's it was far more challenging at the very beginning. I
Yeah.
couldn't afford a cameraman anyway, so it was myself as much as I could. But I would not learn the editing, the computer stuff. I mean, my hands are way too big to work computers really well anyway. It was like, I'll never be a musician for the same reasons. So
man. Well,
Cody with his little tiny hands was perfect for. I hope he listens to this. I'd love this. I just saw Cody this week. I love him dearly, but we sure take cheap shots at each other
those are
constantly.
the best type of friends to have.
Yeah, well, that's when you know you respect each other, when you're not afraid to
Exactly.
once you stop cheap shotting somebody and making jokes about at their expense, it
Yeah.
means they're worried about you or you're not friends anymore.
I'm the same way, man. I'm like, if I'm not making fun of you and joking around with you, we're not friends.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, it's a sign of respect for us in our world. Yeah, say Cody started on my first Hunting Adventures TV show, and then that morphed into well, professionals. That was when my son came on board, Brent.
Which I did a podcast with him a couple weeks ago, and I met him
Okay.
at SHOT Show, and so that was fun.
Yeah, he's a genius. I mean, smartest person I know. We call him Amadeus Mozart behind his back. He doesn't like that. He's too humble, which if I
Yeah, he's a
had
great guy.
this much of his talent, I would be insufferable. I'd be Mick Jagger strutting all over the place. Like, look at me. He's so talented, but so humble, and
Yeah.
everybody just loves him. He's a good guy.
Yeah, for sure. And then that became Uncharted, I guess, correct?
Well, Uncharted, yeah. Professionals
Well, not
morphed into
became, but
Uncharted.
yeah.
You know, the Professionals was a half-hour TV show we did for 4 years. There was elements of it that I loved and elements that I knew need to be separated off, which we did eventually. Like I say, the last 5 minutes we now call shock therapy. So there were great elements to it, but I, you know, the storytelling, we couldn't, in a half-hour format, we couldn't tell the story of hunting.
It's tough to squeeze it all, like a 10-day trip into 22 minutes. It's.
No, and when you actually get down to it, you have about 14 and a half minutes to tell the whole hunting trip of 10 days, you know, when you take out the intros and the outros and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So we flipped it to an hour format, and that was the big step. It was first hour long television show in the outdoor world, and that was Uncharted, and Brandon was producing it. So we did Uncharted for 5 years and then morphed it into Uncharted Yukon for 2 years. And then, honestly, the money dried up. The money that we needed for to produce the show, we couldn't get anymore because social media basically was draining some of the dollars from the marketing dollars from the various manufacturers that are the reason we have such a great, solid hunting television background in this, you know, in this industry, because the manufacturers, thank goodness, put their money into it. But now start catering to the social media as well. No one really knew what
Yeah,
was going to
and YouTube, it's so interesting now because like I feel like the industry sort of still has one foot in the door with TV, but it's very much like shifting. And so just I don't even know if you know this, but I just finished my first season of a show on Sportsman Channel, but I'm also trying to do digital like YouTube and the podcast and stuff and do that well. You know, I'm at the beginning of my career, I got three young kids, and I definitely respect you a ton, and I would love to be you when I grow up. What is your advice
Be
to
careful what you wish
in my
for.
position? What advice would you give me, man?
Well, first of all, what I say is, you're good from far, but far from good. Here, I'll you know, be careful when you say you want to be me when you grow up.
Nah.
But you know, it's pretty simple, really. If you're the young people coming up, I say just be who you are, you know. And if you want to try it, that's sustainable for your entire life. Be who you are. Be honest. That's the best host, the best, most interesting thing you'll ever be as yourself. If you try and act, you better be Brad Pitt, or it's not going to work. And I haven't met Brad Pitt in our industry yet. The ones that are natural at it, Michael Waddell's, you know, they it doesn't matter about the camera. That's just who they are. Their personalities are entertaining, and so everybody that wants to get into television wants to be I guess sign hats. Do selfies with people. Be yourself first. Just be yourself. And if it's not good enough, then go find a different job. But you know, if you try and act to be something else, it's never going to resonate with anybody. The viewers are too sophisticated
For
nowadays.
sure.
It was easier in my time because, you know, I was at the beginning of all that, beginning of television, beginning of social media. So it was easier to get the followers and the fan base. Now, you know, there's 1,000 people that are all trying for the same thing that in those days there might have been 20 of us that were making the effort. And so some of what I'll say maybe not won't translate to today's world, because essentially, you know, I outworked everybody. I worked 9 or 7 days a week, 24/7. I never took holidays. But it wasn't work for me. I lived it. I was actually living it. You know, I wasn't working at a manufacturing job and trying to have a TV show as well. I lived it. This is who I was. It was not so it wasn't work, but it was 24/7 of
When you
living
enjoy
that.
your work, like you're obsessed with it and you're thinking about it all the time, it's not work.
It's not work. No, you never, they say you never work a day in your life. And eventually people, they drop off because they didn't have the desire to actually be that, you know, to be who I just was. You know, they didn't want to, they wanted their fancy cars or trucks, or they wanted a manufacturer, wanted more money, wanted a private jet. I don't know what they wanted, but they got sidetracked. And so after 40 years, they're just gone. You know, they're not there anymore, and they're not, you know, they picked it up again, and they're, you know, they're maybe on the totem pole somewhere, but it was just attrition, you know, just pure brute, like force of will, desire that kept me going in that direction. And what I say is, if you drive in one direction for half a century, you end up somewhere. No side roads, no stops, just go, you know. And they stopped, and they, you know, went aside, oh, let's go on holidays, let's do this, let's do this. I never did that. I just kept going. So I would tell anybody, you just outwork everybody, number one. You'll work harder, you'll work more, work longer, and work hopefully better as you get the experience. You get better and better and better at what you're doing. So that was, that worked for me. It's kind of simplistic in
Oh, I
today's
love that.
world.
That speaks to me, man. It's just like just keep going.
Yeah, that's, yeah, never, there's a million reasons why not to do something. A million of them, pick one. But there's only one good reason to do it, and that's your desire, because I desire to do it, and that supersedes all that other stuff. Just go do it, and keep doing it, and don't let, well, the haters, we talked about them earlier, don't let them get to you. You know, the jealous people, the envious people, the naysayers, the ones that want you to fail because they don't want you to rise above them. They don't want you to be the tall poppy. They're going to try and cut you off if you grow above them. You know, what's that parable about the two farmers, and God gave them each a cow, and the one guy worked really hard and, you know, got enough money from his farm to buy a second cow, and the other guy complained at God. Yeah, he said, you want me to give you a second cow? Is that it? He says, no, I want you to kill his cow. You know, so you're back to one cow each. You know, like, this is, you know, ignore those people, ignore them, and remember, every single day is precious. Every minute of every day is precious. I mean, I always knew that. I always knew that, and I always lived like that. But boy, that's really been driven home to me. You know, dealing with losing Louise. You know how important every single minute of every day is, and that never waste a day. You know, just never waste a day. They never waste a minute of a day. You know, that's kind of, how's that for advice? It's not exactly like,
No,
here's
I
the
love it.
magic pill, just take this and you'll be, you know, signing hats someday.
No, I love it because, to be in this business, you have to love it or you will fall off because it's not the place to like make a quick buck. It's hard work. People think, oh, he just gets to hunt all the time, blah, blah, blah. But no, it really is tough, especially if you're kind of like starting off and you're one man band like myself. But I can see that already in the short amount of time that people do start to drop off, and if you just keep grinding, keep grinding, keep grinding, and I'm blessed to be able to do it. And I've also experienced the people that, like you said, that want to cut you
Of
off.
course, yeah. They don't want to see your success. They're not. They
Which is
don't have
sad.
the. Yeah, it's again tolerance, and we talked about that earlier. Envy, yeah, jealousy. It's human nature. But just ignore them, and just keep stay in the course on whatever you want to do. And like I say, it's harder. I honestly think it's harder for you, and, you know, what people in your position, because you've got something that, this social media, and the people that I'm seeing that are successful at it, are a lot of them are doing things that are just a little bit on the outlandish side. You know, like, I would say, if you want to get a big social media following, go learn to walk on your hands upside down naked and shoot a bow with your feet, and you're gonna, you know, you may never get a deer, but you're going to have people wanting to see this viral video, and you'll get a million views. And and to me, it's like, ugh,
Yeah, you're a clown at that point. And
you're a clown. Of
yeah.
course you are. You're a caricature. You're a goof. I watched it. I mean, I watched it.
That's what scares me about like YouTube and stuff, because I like YouTube and you have to have a big YouTube presence now. But I don't like the I was talking to Branlin about this. I don't like the very idea of, in a way, putting the keys of like what we do, our industry, like make telling hunting stories, we're like handing the keys of that over to big tech by making YouTube like the place for content. You know what I mean? Like, it's scary
Yeah,
to me.
of course it is. And
They
also
could
with
shut
no
it down
quality.
like that if they wanted.
Yeah, and there's no quality control on it. So their messaging, when it's all just about engagement and eyeballs, we've lost the soul of the messaging. So, my goal is to, in my lifetime, help with the non-hunting public's opinion of hunting and hunters in a positive way. That's not there on social media. It's just whatever, if I'm a endowed girl, I want to be as low cut as I can, and let's go noodling for a catfish in a wet t-shirt. I mean, it okay,
Yeah.
you got followers and you're cute, and every young guy out there drools after you, but did you really actually help hunting at all, or hunting or fishing
Yes.
even? What have you actually done? But there, it's no, not everyone cares anymore. And that's what I'm seeing is that, and the more people that don't care, the more the trend just goes away from telling the story of hunting, what it's really truly about. And that's not defensible in the long run. It's
Yeah.
going to turn off the mainstream media. They're going to go, what a bunch of goofs,
Yep.
pink purple hair, with no morals, because look what they're wearing on doing this. And I'm not judging just the females, it's the guys too.
Yeah.
Separated up, doing the look, oh my, it's not real. And it's not going to stand the test of time. But right now, that's what you're dealing with on your
Yeah.
trying to rise above that. How do you rise? How do you get noticed in that goo that's out there?
And it's so hard to stay. I'm not like whining here, but like it's so hard to, because a guy like me, I have to be able to show, I have these numbers on social, like you're saying, I have to kind of show growth, and it's something that I must be in, but also trying to keep that, 'cause you're like what I more closer to what I aspire to be. Like, there's depth, there's knowledge, there's a connection. It's not just, like you said, clickbait. So that's what I strive for, but it's always that temptation to, well, what could I just throw out there right now and get, a bunch of views on or something. So.
Yeah. And that's a tough one. Like I say, it's tougher now because there's so much information out there, so much content. When I was doing it, there wasn't a lot of content. So, you could actually check and say, oh, that's better content. And then viewers tended to gravitate to that.
Right.
Now, how do you find that? I mean, Google moose hunting and see what happens. There will be thousands of moose hunts on YouTube, on whatever, that you can click. Well, you'll spend your lifetime just looking at what's on there right now. So how does anybody stand out in this if they weren't there at the very beginning? You think, I mean, I don't know what I've got on social media, maybe 1.3 million followers altogether on all three platforms. But for me to start right now and try and get there, and you've got, Mark Zuckerberg's a lot smarter than he was too. He's
Oh,
got the
yeah.
algorithm now. So he wants your money. If you want to get more than 20,000 followers, he wants your money. You're gonna have
Oh,
to
yeah.
pay
You
for it.
got to pay.
But at the beginning, it didn't. It was
Right.
just we started in on it, and I was late, not late. I just wasn't that interested in Instagram. I'm still not as interested in it. To me, Facebook is still the demographic that's got the money, that's really truly engaged. Instagram, less so, younger, less money, and whatever the newest one is, no money whatsoever. So I don't care if someone's got 10 million followers on it. It's like they're not spending money on anything. Now, Kardashians, yeah, they're probably buying Kardashians lipstick or whatever they sell, but they have that money. But in our world, not so much.
Well, yeah, that's I guess what I aspired and what I hopefully learned from looking at a guy like you, who again I respect so much, is having that true depth of connection, the authenticity, really representing hunters who are, for who we truly are, which is not dumb, idiot rednecks. Yes, there are dumb idiot redneck hunters, but there are also
There's
other
dumb
guys
idiot
like
rednecks
you.
everywhere. Huh?
Yeah, but there's guys like you that have incredible depth and love and knowledge of the natural world. And anyway, man, I could sit here literally. I say this a lot, but I literally wish we could sit here and talk for 3 more hours. But I want to respect your time, so I hope we can maybe have another conversation again one time, one day. But where can people find like the book and everything you're doing and stuff?
Well, I mean, they can go to Jim Shockey. Dot com. No, I guess what is it? JimShockey.com, I guess, my website. I don't look at that stuff, but yeah, follow me on Instagram or Facebook, or I think I even do Twitter. So that yeah, they can, if they want to follow what's on my regular life, there you go. They can follow my Hand of Man Museum site as well, and that'll give
Oh,
them
okay.
a little, so we video from the
I really want
museum.
to come check out the museum, man. It sounds really cool.
Yeah, you'll love it. It's way bigger and way better than you're imagining. No one, the number one word people have is overwhelming when they see it. It's
Wow. And you personally collected all the stuff in there?
yeah,
Wow.
pretty much everything. There's some things like arrowheads had to come out of old collections back in the day, but I found the collections wherever they were. But I've also found hundreds and hundreds of arrowheads here that are mine.
That's
But
so
yeah,
cool.
everything else.
I've started a mini Jim Shockey museum behind me of just
Perfect.
every time I go on a trip, I get bring back a rock or a fossil, or hopefully a skull, some meat, you know.
That's, well, we're all natural historians. That's,
I
I
gotta show you
love
this one.
it.
You see that?
Ammonite, yeah,
That's
beautiful.
a good one, huh?
Yeah, that's a gorgeous one. See that? There's not one hunter in the world that wouldn't stop and look at that. Because we're naturalists. That's what we are. We're naturalists. That,
100%, yeah.
in fact, it doesn't even say hunter on my website. I'm a naturalist. And I believe in field-to-table living, and that's all part of living a natural life. So
Totally.
yeah, you'll love the museum. You can follow me on that, handofman.org. I think it's, I'm not sure, but and also my Rogue River Outfitters site. That's the guys say, you don't have hunting content on your social media. I do. It's the Rogue River Outfitters. That's where I'm all my
Okay.
hunting. And that, I don't know, there's 50,000 followers of that. So you can go to that as well, and get all the hunting, stuff you want to see, the animals and
Do you still like take hunters out?
well, I outfit, yeah. I mean, we outfit.
But do you personally still?
I got fired from my own outfit a few years back. I'm getting too old and too crabby, and if the hunter can't walk, what's the biggest animal? And can't shoot, and it was great at the beginning. I had patience, but I've lost the patience that you need to be a professional guide. So I will guide. I mean, I'll guide Bruce Pettit from Leupold, the CEO of Leupold here, I think next week, in my
Oh,
own
cool.
bear territory. We're opening right now, so my guys are up there right now guiding.
Well, you can take me, you can yell at me all you want.
Well, hopefully I don't yell. I get frustrated.
Yeah,
But
no, I'm just messing with you.
you're in good shape and can do walk the walk. But I, also I have to look realistically at the future, and how many more years do I have left? I'm 66. Now, if I push it really hard, 80. So I've got 14 years and 14 bear seasons, 14 moose seasons.
Wow.
So I want to use that time guiding someone else, which I've done for, I've guided hundreds of hunters personally over the years. I mean, that's hundreds, probably 400 hunters now, personally, and outfitted for probably 3,000 hunters. Do I only use the rest of my time that I have on this planet, those weeks, and there, and I'm gonna, no matter how much I look in the mirror and go, you ain't the same man you used to be, and that's probably gonna continue that degradation of my abilities. Physically, hopefully not mentally, but in the next 14 years. So, do I want to use those weeks that I have left? And I can measure it in weeks now. over 14 years, how many weeks do I have to guide moose? Do I want to guide someone else? I have young guys that are really capable and they've been trained.
Right.
We've trained. They've gone to guide university in our camps. Or do I want to be with family and really
Of
close
course,
friends?
yeah, of course.
So that's why I don't guide. Honestly, it's not, I say it's because I'm crabby. Hopefully I'm not crabby, but I mean, I do get frustrated,
No, yeah.
with family, and I don't get caught up in the giant. It's got to be this big or something. No, it's the hunt. And family doesn't, they know that. Now, if I was guiding Eva and a giant moose walked out, she'd be somebody I used to know, get out of the way. I'd shoot it. But no, I just don't guide a lot, but still outfit as much as ever.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. No, I totally get that. And that's got to be a kind of sobering to count those weeks. But hey, it's coming for all of us. We got to live the most of it while we can, right? So
Well, that's why I don't let a minute escape. And I never
exactly.
have. I have no regrets. Yeah, that's why I can look forward and go, I'm not sitting here looking back, oh, I didn't do this or I didn't. No, I did everything I wanted to. And
Yeah.
I'm going to do everything I need to do and want to do going forward. I won't let a single minute, I won't let yesterday steal today either
Yeah.
or steal tomorrow. I'm not, and I'm knowing that the future is, I mean, there's a dead end out here for me. And knowing that, I'm not going to let tomorrow steal today either. Worrying about that, I don't care. But I'm sure going to live today and I'm going to do what I want today, every minute, every day, every week, every month, and every year that I have left.
Wow, man. So cool. Well, I've really enjoyed talking to you. I really appreciate your time. I don't want to, like I said, I hope this is not our last conversation because I feel like I just keep talking. But thank you so much for your time, man. It's been really, really fun talking to you.
That's my pleasure. And you know how to get a hold of me now. So we'll definitely do this again.
If I do see you somewhere, can I get a shoulder tap pass?
Absolutely. Make sure you tell me who you are because those shows are conventions. My own mother, back in the day was at one of the conventions. I mean, by the middle of a convention, you just.
Oh yeah, it's sensory overload.
I engage with every single person, but I kind of see but don't see, everybody was around, and my own mother, I turn and say, hey, where are you from? And she says, I'm your mother. And everybody howled that was there, and I went, whoa, it's my own mother. And so it's make sure when you tap me on the shoulder, you tell me who you are, what we did.
Yeah, I saw you at the Leupold booth this year at SHOT Show, and I was like, oh man. I really want to talk to that guy, but I was like, I can't do it right now. Too many, like it's crazy. And
Just come over if you see me, and tap me on the shoulder for sure.
great, man. Well, once again, I want to say thank you so much. I really respect everything you've done in your career and just kind of the ambassador you are for the hunting community. We need more guys like you with depth and authenticity. And so I appreciate you, man. Thanks for your time.
It's my pleasure and good to see the younger guys like yourself taking the reins. I love it. I'm glad to see people like yourself taking the reins that are actually sentient and higher sensibilities that are, sorting all this out in their brain and actually, presenting a good positive image of hunting
Yeah.
and hunters. So I think it's great. You guys are the ones in the future. I mean, I've done it. Now I'm, like you say, an ambassador, but you guys are going to be the ones taking over my role. So I'm confident it'll work out great in the future for us.
Well, I appreciate that very much coming from you, sir. So, anyway, good talking to you and have a great rest of your day, man. God bless you. Glad to hear you're happy and doing well.
Yep, having a great, wonderful life. We only get one, so I'm going to live it.
All right, I'll let you to it. Talk to you later, man. Thank you.